The bat cracked like thunder. The ball flew long, finally arcing over the wall into the left field stands. And as the crowd's cheers rose from loud to deafening, the words of the announcer beamed through the radio. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. Bobby Thompson rounded the bases, ending the October 3rd, 1951 game between the Giants and the Dodgers with the shot heard round the world. While the announcer's words etched his victory into the annals of baseball's greatest comeback stories, those same words also marked one of the game's most stunning defeats for pitcher Ralph Branca, who served up the final pitch. For the past 60 years, Branca has been famously reserved about the game, the pitch, and about the eventual revelation that the Giants had set up an elaborate system for stealing signs leading them to victory. Now he finally tells his story in the new book, A Moment in Time, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ralph Branca to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, after all of those years of being reserved about it, is it fun for you now to talk about it in the sense of revisiting this moment?
Well, you know, now I can tell the truth. Don't ask me why. I wanted somebody else to break the story before I talked about it. And I knew about it from 1954 on. And so once Josh Prager wrote in Wall Street Journal that the Giants stole the signs, and then he wrote a book like 5 years later, I told Thompson my tongue was loosened, which meant I could talk about it. I know that he knew that I knew that they had stolen the signs. We never discussed it. And, you know, he never truly admitted he had the sign in that pitch, which I think he was wrong, you know. He should have been a man and said, I had the sign, but it was a tough pitch to hit. But, you know, not everybody hit a home run when he had the signs. And you watch batting practice. Guys know what's coming. Guys are laying it in there. They don't hit the ball out of the park. They hit ground balls and pop-up. Just watch the home run hitting contest. These are home run hitters trying to hit home runs, and they hit ground balls and pop-up. So he made a good swing on it. The ball was absolutely a ball. So, but he knew I pitched him up and in, and he kind of stepped in the bucket and hit it.
The reaction after that, of course, was jubilation for the Giants, but for you, obviously, devastating. You'd get angry calls from Dodgers fans.
Oh, I did, you know, still living at home. I got married like 17 days later. But, you know, my family got phone calls, you know, my sisters, brothers, my mother, you know, angry Dodger fans. I'm still waiting for a certain Giant fan to apologize, saying that me talking about it was a lot of baloney. I wonder how he feels now when the Giants admitted that they stole the signs.
Yeah. Mm.
And the surprising thing to me was that I was friendly with Sal Ivar. Sal was a second-string catcher for the Giants, and he was in the bullpen giving the signs. So, you know, he told me he gave Thompson the sign, you know, both pitches. And the first pitch was you couldn't put any more dead center in the middle. I just blew a fastball right down the middle. I said, Sal, I understand how you won calling the signs at home. You know, they won 16 in a row when they came off a road trip. I said, but I just don't understand how you did so well on the road. He said, we stole them on the road. I went, what? And Herman Franks and Hank Shan sat in the bleachers, dead center field, all the ballparks, and called the signs. Herman Franks had the telescope, and Shantz would give the signs. Well, I said, how about Brooklyn? He said, oh, no, we didn't steal them in Brooklyn. He said, because if they got found out, they were afraid they'd get killed. I said, well, it's too bad, because it would have been the right thing to do. Because I think it's the most despicable act in the history of the game, to go off the field, look through a telescope, and then hook up a buzzer system. I mean, the Cubs, the White Sox, and Cleveland all had scoreboards in center field. The Cubs and White Sox used a flashlight. In fact, the Cubs put up a piece of board so the dugout couldn't see the guy flashing the flashlight from the first base dugout. And Cleveland, the guy sat in the corner, and he sat down, he had White Sox. He put up one in the scoreboard opening in the lower left corner, fastball, two for curve, wiggle him for changeup or slider, whatever the guy's third pitch was. But nobody ever hooked up a buzzer system. And how do you detect a buzzer system? I mean, you can't. So I just think that to do that was despicable, and to steal what was rightfully the Dodgers was wrong. They robbed the Dodger fans of the bragging rights of being in the series, the Dodger owners from representing the National League, and the Dodger players who deserve to have a chance to maybe beat the Yankees in the World Series.
You remain silent about the game and the pitch, but as you mentioned, when the Wall Street Journal revealed in 2001 that the Giants had stolen the signs and that Bobby Thompson most likely knew that a fastball was coming, the news made international headlines, and then you become vindicated. What was the reaction, really, at that moment, but even before then, from that of your teammates?
Well, basically, you know, teammates kept silent about it. Nobody really defended me, you know, in all the years. Jackie came over when it was over and just sat down next to me and said, hey, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have been in this spot. And you know what? I did straighten out the pitching staff. I was in the bullpen. I was going to be the closer until May 28th. Well, I started a game, and I went seven innings, and it rained, and there was a delay for an hour. I went back out and got the last six outs. Now, here's a guy pitched three innings, maybe three times prior to that, from, say, April 12th to May 28th, and I went seven and then went back out and pitched the last eight. I subsequently pitched three more complete games and won them all. And the fifth game, I was losing 1-0 in St. Louis. They took me out for pinch hitter in the top of the eighth, and Hodge hit a home run in the ninth, and we won 2-1. So I straightened out the whole pitching staff because they used a reliever for two innings in five games.
You write in the book that you, as far as your relationship with Bobby Thompson, that you were cordial since, you know, beginning in 1951, and you were a gentleman about it. But that started to wane as time went on.
You know, the first time I met him, I was not cordial. We took a plane together to Toronto, and I was not very nice. It was late 60s. And then in 84, I did my first card show with him. And, you know, we sat there and talked, and they opened the gates. And then we did more card shows. And I got to know him, and I realized that he was just a foot soldier. It was the giant front office, Horace Stoneman, whomever, Leo DeRocher, Herman Franks, his number one coach. And then I blamed Stanky and Alvin Dark, who were the two leaders of the team, like unknown captains, uncalled captains. And I said, so Bobby was just a foot soldier doing what they were doing. But it was very good for Bobby. He hit 365 after they stole the signs, and he was only hitting 238 before that. And he raised his average about 60 points in the last 7 weeks. And he had never hit a home run off of me. And I remember I threw him a curveball knee-high outside and, like, stepped into it and hit a home run. That was his first home run off me since 1946 or 7. And he did hit another one in Ebbets Field, which was really just a fly ball that the wind blew 20 feet into the first row. And then he hit the game-winning home run off me. So he hit three home runs off me when he knew I was coming, but he had never hit a home run off me prior to that. And he hit 256 lifetime.
One of the things that I found interesting in the book, that you were almost traded for Bobby Thompson in 1948.
Yeah, well, Leo loved me. Leo liked me because, you know, he knew I had guts, and if he wanted somebody knocked down, I'd knock him down.
Leo DeRocher.
Yeah. Other guys would talk about knocking guys down, but I was the only one who did it, professionally, you know. I aimed at the guy's chin, and you can get your chin out of the way, you know. Your head moves faster than any part of your body, so. I only hit one guy where I made a mistake. Instead of being at his chin, I threw it in and hit him in the ribs. That's the only guy I remember hitting when I tried to throw a knockdown.
When you're standing on that plate and playing against some of the greats of the game, which you write about in the book, who, looking back all these years later, who did you just admire as an athlete and as a ball player?
Well, in the National League, you had to admire Stan Musial because he was a great hitter. He was a great hitter because he didn't try to pull everything. You know, if you pitch him outside, he'd hit it to left field. And I've seen him hit home runs to left field and home runs to right field. And, you know, he could play the outfield, but he was the best in the National League. The American League, of course, they didn't play against him much, was Joe DiMaggio. Joe never made a mistake in the field, and he did everything right, and, you know, he was very quiet about it. I didn't pitch against Ted Williams too much, only in two games, and you know, I can't really say anything, but I know he was a great hitter. That's just picking up the hitters. The pitchers, you know, National League early on, Warren Spahn would stand out as the best pitcher early on, and then Koufax. And American League, I wasn't in but a little over a year, you know, a year and a couple months, a year and a half. Whitey Ford would be the outstanding pitcher in that league, but Bob Feller was still around. Those were the best players I played against.
As the baseball season winds down and the playoffs and near the World Series, what are you excited about at this time of year? Because this is an exciting time for a baseball fan.
It's an exciting time, but sad time. It means the season's over. I mean, I have baseball extra, and if Yankees or Mets are in a blowout, I just switch over to baseball extra and pick out a game that's interesting, you know, or a team that I want to check on. So my wife and I watch baseball every night. We're sad that the season comes to an end, but we're excited about the playoffs, you know, and it looks like it's going to be good. I mean, Detroit, Texas, the Yankees, and whomever, and then the National League, it's all set. And I think it's going to boil down to Milwaukee and Philadelphia. And Philadelphia doesn't hit enough. Their pitching's going to have to really be sharp against Milwaukee to beat them. So that's a toss-up to me. I think the Yankees pitching is suspect, but they got so much hitting that they should prevail. But, again, Texas has pitching and hitting, and Detroit has Verlander. So they could be tough for the Yankees, both of either of those two clubs.
And you root for the Yankees?
I root for all New York teams. I root for the Yankees. You remember I played for them for 2.5 months.
Right.
Nobody remembers that.
2.5 months.
Right.
2.5 good months?
Yeah, well, they could have been better. They didn't pitch me enough. You know, they started me in a game, and the umpire squeezed me, and then I pitched against the Red Sox. I went 6 innings, and I gave up 1 run and 3 hits, and we went to Boston the next week, and I thought I would get another start against them. And unfortunately, I guess they were afraid I'd throw a home run and I would crumble on the mound. I don't know why they didn't pitch me. But I pitched in relief, and I didn't pitch enough. I only pitched 12 innings. And I had good stuff again. I talked to Yogi. I said, Yogi, at his tournament a couple months ago, I said, Yogi, in 54 when I pitched you, did I have good stuff? You know, I'm trying to think that my back was better now and I was throwing pretty good. He said, yeah, you had real good stuff. I said, and they didn't keep me. Well, I had a bonus of $7,500 coming, and they didn't want to spend $7,500. So I look back on it, they should have invited me to spring training anyhow. I mean, I'd have waived at $7,500 to push out to play with the Yankees in 55, because I was there in 54. So unfortunately, they released me, and unfortunately, it didn't work out after that.
It's refreshing for me to hear you talk so positively and still have a great love for the game, because many of the players who played in your era look at the changes and say that the game is ruined and it's not what it was, and don't have the same respect and fondness for it that you do.
Well, a lot of guys are envious of the money, and you know what? Television not only changed baseball and sports, television changed the world. And so, you know, we have reporters in the front line of a war. And now you have baseball with all the television monies and the prices that they've raised to buy tickets. And so the money's there, and the players. And nobody talks about how much money movie stars get for working 3 months and making $20 million. But a ball player, he's got to perform every day in front of the public. I mean, if you're a guy in an office and you have a bad night, the baby kept you awake all night, whatever, you get to the office, you can push papers and pencils around and get through the day. Nobody's watching. But a ball player, he has to go out and perform. So it's a tough job. And obviously, the owners have the money to pay him. So I don't begrudge him the money. I think just like you can have a short career. It's perilous. You got to stay healthy. And I'm a perfect example of that. I hurt my back at 26 and won 12 games. And I'd like to believe that had I stayed healthy, I would have won my 14 games a year, which I really was averaging, 13, 14 games a year. You know what? 13, 14 games a year means you're a Hall of Famer. Just figure it out. Guy wins 300 and he plays 20 years, so he averages 15 games a year.
Appearing in 3 All-Star games and the starting pitcher in the 1948 All-Star game must have been a highlight.
Yeah, well, you know, people only know me for, you know, throwing a home run pitch, but you got to figure I was 21, 2, and 3, made the All-Star team. I started the first game ever in playoff history at age 20. I'm still the youngest guy to start a postseason game. I started the first game of the World Series. I started an All-Star game. And the second time around, I pitched the opening game in the playoffs in 51. So you know I was a good young pitcher. So unfortunately, I had a big injury in there where guys hit me on the shins and my leg got infected, and it kept me from winning more games, you know, at 22, 3, 4.
When you hear that term now, shot heard around the world, because it's used in many different contexts, how do you receive that when you hear it?
I have no reaction. It means nothing to me because I know I didn't cheat. And, you know, when you put Russ Hodges on, they said the Giants won the pennant. The Giants won the pennant, and I just changed win to stole. The Giants stole a pennant, you know, which is the absolute truth, and I have no qualms about saying it. They stole a pennant. They shouldn't be heroes. They should be regarded as despicable cheaters.
Do you think something like that could happen now? I mean, has that element of the game been eliminated?
Well, they try. I mean, they had a thing in Philadelphia where the bullpen coach was looking into the opposition's signs, you know. He could get the signs and figure out it's the first sign after the second two. Now he relays that to the dugout, and the guy gets on second base, and he pops a peek, and the guy goes 2-1-2, and the next, after the second two, it's whatever, and the guy puts down a 3, it's a slider or a changeup. Or he puts down a 1, it's a fastball. So the guy already knows, and he can signal. He can just stand up straight, fastball, bend over for curve, cross his feet for the third pitch, whatever. And then you had something up in Toronto where the guy was in the hotel in center field. Yeah, you get a telescope, like the Giants supposed that telescope was a Wallensack, and that was supposed to be able to see a fly on a chimney 300 feet away. Well, that's a pretty powerful telescope. But, you know, it was in the Navy, and you could see 25 miles away.
Well, the book is just incredible. It's A Moment in Time, an American Story of Baseball, Heartbreak, and Grace. Ralph Branca, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I can't thank you enough for spending time with us, and I wish you all the luck in the world.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for the call. And the book, you know, I'll tell you the book. I've given it to friends, you know, and they've read, and they like it. Said it's an easy read, and they love hearing about the old days. You know, some of them are old enough to be around in the 40s and 50s. So I think people would really enjoy the book.
It's A Moment in Time. It's published by Scribner. Ralph Branca, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Again, the name of the book, A Moment in Time. It's published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
And now for the defense. From the Brooklyn Dodgers, Ralph Branca. So let's hear it.
Because of you, I should never been born. Because of you, Brooklyn fans are forlorn. Because of you, they yell, drop dead. Several million want my head to sever forever in scorn. One lonely bird had a word for my ear. The only girl, what a pearl of good cheer. I lost the game, still wound up with the dame. She took my